Welcome to Business IQ Radio. I'm your co-host, Andrea O'Brien, and I'm here with my best co-host ever, Don Byrne. Hi, Don. How are you?
Good. Am I the co-host? Is that what I am?
That's great. You're the co-host.
Yeah, I'm the co-host. That's great. I like Coco.
We have a wonderful show today. It's a tricky topic because when I tell you what the topic is, your eyes might gloss over, but maybe not.
Yeah, don't touch that dial until you hear more.
Does the word federal tax code mean anything to you?
No. Let's do it this way. Does a 20% deduction mean anything to you?
Oh, music to my ears.
All right.
Music to every business's ears if they're able to know how to take advantage of it.
Right.
And our guest today, I kind of consider him, I want to say like the grandfather of the LLC statute in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it. He, with his team, and he can tell us more about that, decided to make the LLC a real option for business formation.
Well, who is this amazing person?
His name is attorney John Cunningham. He has his own solo law practice, but he's also of counsel to McLean Middleton in Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And for 20 years, he's focused on LLC law and tax law. So he's an expert. I would call him a subject
real deal.
Matter expert. Yep.
He's the real deal.
And he has studied the new tax laws that came out last year. And he's here today to talk to us about a very specific section of that law called 199A. And it became effective January 1st, 2018. So if you are a business owner, you need to know about 199A. And our show today is going to focus on that. So,
and my little bit of understanding, and I look forward to learning a lot more from John, is that this is extremely relevant if you are a small business owner, if you are an individual owner, or if you're part of a small team. This is not as if you're part of General Motors or Apple or something like that. This is really designed for people who are, you know, the typical business owner here in Bedford or other parts of New Hampshire, right?
Right. I mean, it's hopefully he'll go into some detail as to, you know, who it applies to. And
we'll extract that information from him one way or the other.
Yes.
We have an attorney. We won't have a problem having him explain things to us.
We'll depose him. No.
We'll dispose of him, right?
No.
That's right.
No, it's great that he made the time to come and talk to us. He's a published author as well.
Great.
And he has a new book coming out in October.
Well, terrific. Well, you know, let's not delay anymore. Let's perhaps welcome Mr. John Cunningham in. I'll turn over to you to do that.
John, thanks so much for coming to the studio today, and thanks for being our expert, our subject matter expert on the broader topic of tax law.
Something of interest to everyone, not only in New Hampshire, but in the world.
Something of interest, and just the word tax sort of makes people in New Hampshire particularly just cringe.
Well, it certainly gets blood flowing for sure.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody driving off the road as you're listening to this particular discussion.
But before our listeners know this, but before we delve into the topic, we want to know more about you and, you know, your background, what brought you to New Hampshire, and why, you know, what.
And are you current on all of your taxes?
No,
we won't ask that question until later on. That's the probing part of where we are, our journalistic investigation.
Right. So help us out. Tell us where the story began.
Well, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and my wife, Martha, had come from Boulder Hill Farm near Concord in Hopkinton, and we met and we fell in love and we got married. But before that, growing up in Baltimore, I went to a Jesuit high school. That's an order of Roman Catholic priests, and I was impressed with them. So I joined up, and as listeners may know, the Jesuits are famous for teaching and writing. And that's what I loved to do. So I was in for 9 years, and then I knew I needed a family, so I left. And I couldn't figure out what in the world am I going to do. So I did what many people in that situation do. They say, can't think of anything else to do. I think I'll become a lawyer. And if you'd said, oh, that's fine, John, but what do lawyers do? Yeah. I would have said, darned if I know. But anyway, I went into the law, but and then had a bunch of jobs and was always deeply unhappy. And I think I know the reason this actually is leading to our topic, that I wanted to do something where I was on my own and could be creative, where it was something new, where I could make my own rules instead of being told you must do it this way or that way. And I wanted it to involve teaching, and I wanted it to involve writing because that was who I was and am. And it's hard to find a slot like that in the law, very hard, and it took me decades to do it. But for family reasons, we ended up in Concord, New Hampshire. And by dumb luck, I happened to know that there was this, pardon this word because I'm going to use it again and again, amazing new business form called Limited Liability Companies, LLC. And I said, wait a minute, no one knows anything about LLCs. No one can tell me how I should do LLCs. Let's have an LLC statute in New York and in New Hampshire. And I happened to know a wonderful guy at the firm where I'm of counsel now, a fellow named Dick Samuels. And I called up Dick and I said, we need an LLC statute. And he said, what's that? And I said, here's what it is. It's a whole brand new type of business organization. And it is really cool because above all, it provides great flexibility and room for lawyer flexibility. And so he said, let's do it. So we formed in 93, we enacted it. And then in 97, there was a big tax change and we made major changes. And I kept sort of, we didn't know what the heck we were doing.
So are you saying before 1993, there wasn't really the option of becoming an LLC?
There was not. We didn't have a state statute.
So what did people do mostly? Was it?
They formed business corporations, which are really designed for entirely different purposes to mobilize large amounts of capital for national businesses, which is exactly the opposite of what most New Hampshire business people are doing. They're doing stuff very locally, maybe starting on literally a shoestring. So I always felt that the business corporation didn't make legal sense. And when the LLC came along, that where basically the LLC statute says, do whatever you want, it's legal.
That's perfect.
Not quite that simple, but not too far off from that.
And it's it's better than a sole proprietorship.
It's completely different than a sole proprietorship because it gives you a liability shield. In other words, if you get sued and you weren't personally responsible, you're protected, unlike a state law sole proprietorship. So I said, this is fantastic. And we got the thing rolling and I wrote some articles about it because I was learning, you know, how to use it and how not to use it. And Dick said to me one day in the halls of our law firm, because he said, you know, you've been calling for the reform of the LLC Act. I want you to go and reform it. And he happened to be the president of the Business and Industry Association at the time. So I said, yes, sir. And I'd written a book about LLCs, a very long, complex book. And basically, I just took the book and recast it as a statute with the agreement of an excellent BIA committee that I was the chairman of. And we were off and running. And the great thing about it from my viewpoint is that there were endless topics that you could write about. And there were endless topics that you could teach about. So I teach nationwide and I teach business people in Manchester and teach. I love teaching. If someone said, which do you love more, practicing law or teaching? I couldn't answer that. And I was writing like crazy. Like my book is called Drafting Limited Liability Company Operating Agreements. It's 2,000 pages long now. I've been writing it for 20 years. So
we have to get you a hobby.
I was going to say you're so convincing.
That's what my wife says. But then again, by sort of dumb luck, well, a little bit more than that, I learned about this. Pardon the adjective. Amazing new section effective January 1, 2018, called Section 199A. And I said a couple of things to myself when I began to learn about it. First of all, unfortunately or fortunately, I have to learn about this statute because it is going to be at the very core of my LLC practice. That's what I have done up until now, form LLCs, and then the fun part when LLC members decide that they hate each other, they call me in and I try to fix things for one side or the other, or both sides. So that's nice, and it's a fun practice. But LLCs are very tax sensitive. And I although I didn't know anything about 199A, I quickly sensed that it was at the very core of LLC tax practice, whether it's a single-member LLC or a multi-member LLC with 100 members and $600 million of capital. So, yes.
So this section of noted as 199A, is that that's a federal?
Yes.
Federal.
It's in the Internal Revenue Code 199A.
And is this part of the tax reform that the Trump administration just rolled out?
Yes, and thereby lies a story. What 199A basically does is truly amazing, as you're about to find out. It gives a deduction of up to 20% of your net business income if you are a so-called pass-through business, and I'll explain that in a minute. But basically, what happened is that, as I'm sure you know, the main thing that the Trump Tax Reform Act did was to give enormous tax breaks to large corporations. And what this did, it's worrisome because there is going to be enormous trillion-dollar deficits coming out of it. But another thing that it did is it put the small business, which didn't get the tax breaks, in a terrible position competitively with the big companies. And so what Congress did and really had to do was enact 199A, because it says, okay, we're going to restore you to the tax competitive situation that you had before the billions of tax breaks we gave to the big companies. We're going to create this thing called 199A, and it's going to give you up to 20% off your tax bill too, or not tax bill, but net tax income. And so say you're earning $80,000 a year, you only pay tax under this rule on $64,000 a year, and this saves you like $3,500 a year in taxes, which could mean the difference between business success in business failure. And how many people does this thing affect? How many small business owners? Around, are you ready for this? 50 or 60 million.
Wow.
It's absolutely unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Is there a minimum amount of revenue earnings that a business has to take in or claim in order to use this?
No. If you earn $1 in year one, which wouldn't be unusual for a business startup, you pay tax on 80 cents.
Hmm.
If you earn couple hundred thousand bucks, you pay tax on far less. And basically, if you're earning $200,000 or $300,000, you're saving $750 of tax for every $10,000 of your taxable income. So some people, your typical New Hampshire business is probably going to save neighborhood $300,000 a year in tax, in federal income taxes. We're not talking state.
That's
federal,
great.
Federal. And if you're a rich guy who's making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, he could be saving $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year in taxes. Hmm. It's unbelievable, but not so unbelievable if you understand the reason for it, namely, hey, the rich guys got billions off. We're mm-hmm. going to throw a few crumbs at the little guys, too.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting.
It is exciting.
I think that's exciting.
Is this something that's not yet well known, John? It sounds as if you are really, once again, leading the pack. I'm not sure how many other attorneys. I haven't heard any other attorneys or tax professionals talk about
this. No. And one reason is that if you were to read 199A, which I don't recommend unless you're...
I finish your book, I promise.
if you're a tax expert, even if you're a tax expert, the first time you read it, you'll say, what is this, Chinese? I don't understand one syllable of this. And one reason is that they use all sorts of what tax lawyers call defined terms early on, which right. they don't define until the very end of the statute. So, of course, you don't understand it.
Yeah.
It's written that way. And even after you do understand it, it's horrible to really understand. And since I knew that this was going to be at the core of my own LLC and general tax practice, I knew I had to understand it from beginning to end. And I find, I suspect this is true of a lot of people, that I can't really get my thoughts clear unless I write them down. And so I figured, you know what? I'm going to write a book about this thing.
Well, this is a good opportunity for me to ask you a question that I've heard. I've been told a few things, which is legislatures promulgate laws, courts and judges interpret laws, and that it's not until there are some number of court cases and holdings do we really understand what a law means. Does that apply to something like this, or is that really more criminal kind of laws?
It's much more criminal. Here, you start with the statute, and you say, what the heck is this statute is saying? And then there are proposed regs, and these proposed regulations came out on August the 8th, 2018. And they answer some of the ambiguities, but by no means all of them. Tax professionals submit comments and say, we still don't understand what 199AD little b means.
Sure.
And hopefully the final regulations will respond to those comments. But there'll always be some gray areas, and that's when there could be what we call revenue rulings or revenue procedures. But there's going to be some very major stuff that's also going to have to be decided by the courts.
Is it just for LLCs? I mean, the LLC law is something that New Hampshire embraces or is a New Hampshire recognized entity. But
chapter S corps you're talking about?
Let me teach you something extremely basic about law and tax, that they are two separate worlds. LLCs are a pure law term. It means a very, very flexible state entity that you form by submitting a form to the Secretary of State. And they're in all U.S. jurisdictions now, the 50 states and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, for that matter, and the Virgin Islands. But so that's a pure law term. The relevant tax terms are sole proprietorship, and you can be an LLC from a law viewpoint and a sole proprietor from a tax viewpoint because you're the only owner of your business. And then there are subchapter S corporations, and you can be an LLC from a law viewpoint and a subchapter S from a tax viewpoint. It sounds crazy. It's how can you be Jewish and Catholic at the same time? How can you be an LLC and subchapter S? It's because there's law over here and tax over there. So you can be an LLC from a law viewpoint and a subchapter S corporation, a corporation from a tax viewpoint, or you can be an LLC if it's multi-owner. If you have two or more owners, you can be a multi-member LLC for law purposes, but a partnership under subchapter K of the Internal Revenue Code for federal income tax purposes. Or you could be, just to make things more complicated, a subchapter C corporation, which is a very bad tax regimen to have. But some people, they start their own companies. They don't have an accountant. So they're automatically a subchapter. They're an LLC or a state law business corporation from a law viewpoint, but they're a subchapter C corporation from a tax viewpoint. It's a bad situation.
Would that be somebody who didn't get good advice?
Yes.
Yeah.
Almost always. Mm. But no matter, if you're an LLC, you can be any tax regimen. You can be a sole proprietorship if you've got one member. You can be a single shareholder S corporation, which probably many listeners to this program mm-hmm. are. You can be a C corp, single shareholder C corporation. And if you have two or more members, you can be a subchapter S, subchapter C partnership. So there's great flexibility there, but you need good advice about which one is going to be the best for you.
You know, that's what we tell when clients come into our office. So we do business advising, and when clients come into our office and want to know what is the, you know, what should they be, I know it's very much a legal area of discussion.
Well, what business organization form
yes.
should we be, either an LLC or, in very rare cases, a business corporation? Most business corporations in New Hampshire shouldn't be business corporations. The lawyer made a mistake. The client made a mistake. They should be LLCs because it's better law.
Yeah.
Then there's the issue of, okay, but what federal tax regimen should we have?
Right.
That's a completely different question. Mars and Venus.
And so who would you say is the best to advise a business on that? Their accountant, their lawyer, a mixture of both?
SBDC.
Their mother.
Probably not their mother. My personal view is that if you're going to be an LLC lawyer, you should also be a sophisticated federal tax lawyer. And the reason is you know what this LLC should be from a law viewpoint, but what should it be from a tax viewpoint? The more you know about the legalities you want for it, the more you know about the tax. Now, many an accountant would disagree and say, you know, your average LLC doesn't know nada about tax. And that's true. It's hard work to learn both. But what I advocate is one-stop shopping because the two, the law and the tax, are so very interrelated. So what you want to do is see a business organization lawyer who says, from a law viewpoint, you should be an LLC. From a tax viewpoint, say it's multi-owner, you should be a partnership. But what the tax should be radically changed on 1/1/18 because of the enactment of 199A. And there, the question used to be more complicated than I want to bore you with, speaking of eyes glazing over. But the question is, what should I be from a tax viewpoint if I want to maximize my 199A deduction? We call this tax choice of entity. And it used to be a lot more complicated, actually. You still have to do the complicated part. But the bottom line is probably going to be, you got to be, from a federal tax viewpoint, what's going to maximize your 199A deduction, because there's thousands of bucks in them Nar Hills. And it goes on year after year.
So, John, let me pick up on the thread. As you said, some people have made some mistakes up to now. What can I do? If I made a mistake, can I change? Do I have to dissolve my corporation? I know that if you are a corporation or an LLC, you can one time change the nature of your organization. But I don't know if that is a tax, if there's equivalent in the tax code.
I would say, it grieves me to say this, but I've got to say it if I'm going to be honest on this program. Talk to your CPA or your EA, your enrolled agent, your accountant, the one who does your tax returns, and ask him or her point blank, do you have a sophisticated knowledge of 199A? And wild guess, 1/20th of New Hampshire CPAs and EAs do. But I could be wrong about that. Maybe it's 9/10 for all I know. But it's so darn hard to learn that statute. And if there's a single provision in it that you don't understand, that could be the critical provision for your guy, and you may mislead him because you didn't know about 199A sub D 3 capital B. But you ask your CPA or EA, do you have a sophisticated, comprehensive knowledge of 199A? And if they say yes, then you say, how should I be structured from a law viewpoint and a tax viewpoint in order to maximize my deduction? And I'll give you an example. There are tens of thousands of subchapter S corporations. They may be a state law business corporation from a law viewpoint that's an S corporation, or they may be an LLC that's a subchapter S corporation from a tax viewpoint. There's tens of thousands of them in New Hampshire, and if their income is below a certain point, and this would be for married people, $315,000 or below, the taxable income on the joint return. Or if they're single, $157,000. If it's below that $315,000 or $157,000, if they're S-corps, they're killing themselves, because that is going to mean that they're not going to get as much of a deduction under 199A as they could. So what do? They stop being an S-corporation. And if it's single owner, they become a sole proprietorship. If it's multi-owner, they become a partnership. If it's a partnership, there's a wonderful way in which you can protect them, by and large, from FICA taxes, which are called self-employment taxes in the case of partnerships. But they should stop being a subchapter S corporation. And this is heretical.
So you're suggesting they become a sole proprietor, but
if it's single owner.
Single owner, but But are you also including LLC in that, a single member LLC?
It would be from a tax viewpoint, a sole proprietor. From a law viewpoint, an LLC.
Because it's that protection that everybody wants.
And flexibility, yes. Also. And you don't have to have annual meetings. You don't have to have bylaws like you do with corporations. Yeah. You don't have to have shareholder meetings. You don't have to direct them. You don't need to have shareholders, directors, or officers. Yeah. It's just you and your LLC. It's so simple.
Yeah.
You have a staff meeting, you look in the mirror.
Yeah. Yes.
I have a question that comes up a lot, and when we're talking to businesses about an owner's draw versus the owner as an employee and getting a paycheck.
Yes.
Do you have an opinion on that?
It depends on complex facts, and I'd have to have many more facts to give you something rational, but a draw just means an advance payment of your share of profits. That's what it usually means. Sometimes it means an advance payment of your salary. But there's a set of terms you use for entities taxable as partnerships that's very different than the terms you use for S corporations. But beyond that, I can't answer that without more facts.
All right.
So, John, I can just tell from the passion that you have behind this discussion, you are an advocate for the individual and for the small business. So I guess my question is, it seems to me that the small business person owes it to themselves to become better educated about these issues. It's important to be able to go to an expert and ask questions, but you should ask intelligent questions. You should ask questions with some knowledge base. Is there a way that you can propose that people can learn more about these topics?
Well, this is a bit self-serving, but not really. I think I sent to Andrea it's about a two-page overview of subsection of section 199A, and I would like to think that if you read that, you know basically what you need to know for starters. And then you go into your CPA, and let's assume that your CPA is knowledgeable, is expert about 199A. You say to him or her, this is my basic current situation. This is the legal situation that I have. Let's say I'm a multi-shareholder state law business corporation, which is an S corporation, but I want to maximize my my 199A deduction. I want that 20% deduction from my taxable income before I have to pay the feds. And here it gets a little tricky because the CPA can tell you what you should be from a tax viewpoint to maximize your deduction, but he or she cannot tell you, unless they've also got a law degree and they're licensed in New Hampshire, what you should be from a law viewpoint. But I will tell you what you should be, an LLC. It's almost every state law business corporation in New Hampshire shouldn't be a state law business corporation. It should be an LLC because the law is better. Why drive a VW when you could drive a Mercedes? Right.
So, John, we're going to ask you at the end of the show to tell us a little bit how people can reach you, but I think it's relevant now. Can you tell us if people wanted to get access to your two-page write-up or something, is there a website that they can go to or...
Boy, that's a good question. My website is in flux because, as you know, I've written a book about LLCs, which will be published supposedly in October 11th. Okay. And so my website is not up right now, but if they sent me an email, can I give the email?
Please do. Yeah, please do.
LAWJMC at comcast.net. Please send me your 199A overview. I'll send it immediately.
Great. So, and we'll ask you for that again later on. And I'm assuming in the meantime, if people, for some reason, were speaking to you, Andrew, to the SBDC, you could possibly make that available as well. So we'll try to get multiple outlets because it sounds like this is a useful document that is you can hold in your hand and you can get a sense of what's going
on.
Well,
I'll tell you what. I have a couple of good friends who aren't lawyers. And this very afternoon, I sent them this 199A overview, and I said, hey, Sally, does this make sense to you? And hey, Karen, does this make sense to you? And they may say, I don't know what the heck you're saying in this thing, in which event I'll have to change it. But I tried to put it in plain English.
Right. And that's always a challenge with these things.
Well, you know, you talk about eyes glazing over. I can't imagine a more complicated topic than tax law and the overlay, you know, that legal aspect and advising your clients and the tax law is a tough subject.
It really is tough, and it's got all its own, you know, unique terms that what you need here is a provision for a minimum gain chargeback.
What?
This is, you got a 704C1A problem. What? So putting it in English is not real easy, but you have to have a comprehensive knowledge of 199A if you're going to advise people. But there's much more than that. These regs came out. They're like 150 pages of proposed regs that came out 8/8/18.
And is from the Congress?
Or? No, this is from the Treasury Department and the IRS interpreting 199A. Yeah, okay. So you have to know all those interpretations. And the proposed regs, until they become final, you can rely on them as if they were final. Wow. But that's only half of it, because probably, I want to say 80% of all New Hampshire businesses are already properly structured in order to maximize their deduction. But they don't know that. They don't know that. So they got to find that out for sure, because maybe they're not. Mm. And if, for example, if they call me up, I could tell them in 2 minutes, hey, you don't need to change anything. You're golden. I just need a very few basic facts. But 20% need radical change.
Yeah.
And so the hardest part of practice under 199A is to know when you need to restructure your personal affairs. Like, maybe you shouldn't file a joint return anymore. Maybe you should file a separate return. Maybe you need to make less money. Maybe you need to make more money. And above all, maybe you don't need to be a subchapter S anymore. You need to be a partnership. So it's the restructuring which is the most complicated part of the whole deal. And the chapter in my book, which deals with that, I must have rewritten that thing 3 times. And I finally felt like I had it fairly close to right. But that's the real complexity. Advising clients whether they're properly structured, and if they're not, you're off to the races. How should they restructure?
This may not be an appropriate question, but how much is it going to cost a business to possibly restructure? I know everybody's different. Is it?
Wild guess, $2,000.
Okay.
And terribly fact intensive.
Yeah. Yeah. It depends on the facts, right? You're listening to WBNH 105.1 Bedford Community Radio, and this is Business IQ Radio, and our guest today is John Cunningham of...
I have my own solo practice firm called the Law Offices of John M. Cunningham, PLLC. Great. But I'm of counsel, which means I have a working relationship with McLean Middleton, a large New Hampshire firm.
Yes. And is it fair to say that we could call you not an age thing, but the grandfather of LLC in New Hampshire? Is that a fair... Because I remember hearing you speak years ago, and you addressed a group of business people.
Put it this way. I was the guy who realized that we needed an LLC statute back in 92 because we didn't have one. Mm-hmm. But I called up Dick Samuels, the managing partner of the McLean firm, and said, hey, Dick, I think we need to do this. And he said, you know what? You're right. And then he was really the guy who put together the team. So was it my idea originally? Yes, but
you wrote a lot of the statute.
I wrote
or drafted
a fair amount of the original statute, but probably a good 70% of the new statute. Others might disagree, but frankly, a lot of it was taken from my book on LLCs.
Oh, amazing!
I want to go back to something you were just talking about, which is the regulations, the pages coming out. And to really hit and emphasize something you said before, you know, if you call up the IRS and ask questions, they won't tell you definitively this is what you should or should not do. the tax law is so complex that not even the people enforcing the tax law can give you definitive answers to tax questions in many situations. And that's just a crazy situation to have.
Yeah, there's a book called, I wish I could think of the name of it, by a wonderful writer I know named Tom Reed. And it's called, roughly translated, it would be, "This is a royal mess."
Yeah.
And Tom is a lawyer, but he became a journalist for the Washington Post. And now he just writes whatever he wants to write about. And he wrote about the U.S. code. And he said, basically, it stinks. Yeah. It's doing everything wrong. All the basic principles that are agreed to worldwide about what a good tax code should look like, we're doing the opposite.
Right.
It's a profound mess. And think of it. 199A, almost everybody who will make use of it is earning, their business is earning maybe $150,000 at most. They're what we would call little guys. And some of them are earning 50 or 20 and glad to make that. And this thing is written for them. And it's I would say, if you take into account the need that I mentioned a minute ago about evaluating your structure and how to restructure, it's the most complicated provision in the Internal Revenue Code. And even a tax expert who reads it for the first time won't understand it. It will take him or her many hours, not to mention the proposed regs.
Why would they do that? Why would they make something so complicated that we are all subject to?
Because they're all lawyers.
Well, job security.
I didn't say that out loud, did I?
I actually write about this at length in my book about this subject. But one of the reasons is, speaking of lawyers, that they decided that what might be called non-professional businesses should get a much better deal than the professional businesses. And I'm not sure why that is, because it was written by lawyers who are professionals. But all of the classic professions except architecture and engineering are called specified service trades or businesses, and they basically get screwed. Fortunately, not if they're earning less than $315 jointly, or $157 if they file separately.
Single, yeah.
But if you're over that, you are royally screwed, because you're a specified service trade or business. They call them SSTBs. And so immediately you have this kind of schizophrenia written into the act, and then you have all sorts of other weird stuff if they didn't have qualified trades or businesses versus specified service trades or business, everything would become much simpler. You have a deduction for people at a certain level. You have another deduction for people at a higher level, another and another. So there's four separate major rules that govern your deduction. And sometimes it's very hard to tell which of those there is. What if they just had 20% across the board?
Would that be nice?
It would be so simple. You could put it in a sentence.
Well, I wanted to ask you your opinion on, you know, every election time I feel like we discuss how to simplify the tax code, and there should be a flat tax at one income level and another flat tax, or maybe just a flat tax at all income levels. What do you think about that?
Oh, I have strong feelings about that. My feeling is that it's a very great country. I'm a little worried about it now. That's not the topic of our discussion, but it seems to me, to put it in one word, tax the rich. We're all so enriched by living in this country, but the more you make, the more you should pay. In other words, we should have a sharply progressive federal income tax system. And the whole original reason for estate taxes was to make for income equality. So we should have a major estate tax. And if you put those two things together, and maybe Trump will do that later on. Maybe if the Democrats retake power, they'll do it. Then we could have infrastructure and create millions of jobs, and people wouldn't feel like they were screwed because they were in the middle class, like tens of millions of middle class Americans do now, especially the younger ones who will never own a house. How can they even get married? If they do get married, how can they send their kids to college? That's all got to be fixed. And the way you do it with is sharply progressive federal income taxes and a major estate tax. Don't call it a death tax.
You'll never get elected. It's good thing you're not running for office.
And since I'm not running for office, what should we do in New Hampshire? The same damn thing. It is horrible what we do to people who have beautiful old homes that they've lived in for generations and they can't afford the property tax. So we should have a progressive state income tax. I know a lot of people.
A progressive state property tax.
A property tax, the less money you have, the less should be your tax.
Ah, right.
And especially for the elderly.
Yeah. And let me just say that the three of us in the room probably qualify for that. So I'm all in favor for that.
So let me pick up on something you were touching on there as well. We have a growth initiative, at least in the southern part of the state here, around different areas of technology. And there's a real emphasis on STEM, right? Science,
yes.
Technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Yeah, it's great.
And are there different, are different industries, you alluded to some businesses that are treated different. Are different industries treated differently? If I'm a software developer, if I'm a biotechnology, if I'm in pharmacy, are these treated differently under these regulations?
If you're in one of the classic professions and you're making a lot of money, I'll put it crudely, you're going to get screwed.
Like if I were a medical doctor.
Yeah, you're going to get screwed. And if you're a lawyer. Nothing wrong with that.
I didn't say that out loud.
And if you're an accountant, if you're an actuary, those are the main ones that spring to mind. Or if you're in investment counseling or you're in the investment business.
What about banking?
Interesting that you should ask about that. As you may have heard, the bankers have a powerful lobby.
They do.
And
almost as powerful as the NRA.
And if you read the statute, it looks like banking is nailed. It is a specified service, trade, or business, and the more money they make, the less deduction they get. But for some strange reason, wink, wink, the proposed regs expressly says if you're in the business of taking deposits and making loans, you're a qualified trade or business and you get every break available under 199A. A lot of people feel that this is unethical, but that's what the proposed regs say. Why do they say it? They state a reason, but it doesn't quite make sense.
So should we expect that some of the industry associations are going to be educating, the Banking Association of New Hampshire, the Insurance Association, are they going to take up the gauntlet and educate their members about? I mean, this sounds like this is really a very significant topic that they should know about.
It's incredibly significant, and lots of customers of banks are business owners, and
sure.
lots of clients of investment counselors are business owners. There's many, many different trades or businesses whose clients or customers are business owners, and all the business owners have to know about this. Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's no problem. Okay. I
think that's the president calling.
That's somebody calling us. I wanted to ask you, not to change the subject, but before we run out of time, deducting meals, travel expense, some of the things that, people who own their own businesses have done ordinarily, are those deductions still legitimate?
Yes. You're talking about deductions under Internal Revenue Code 162. And as long as they're ordinary and necessary in the trade or business, that's perfectly okay. But a friend of mine said, gee whiz, this makes it sound like this 199A deduction is a free deduction because all those things like meals, wages, and so forth, you got to pay before you get the deduction. This, you just sit there and you get it. It's a free deduction. That's one of the things that's so astounding about it.
Well, why did I think that the meals deduction was no longer going to be able to be taken?
Well, it's been very restricted, but it's still there, if it's an absolute business necessity.
Okay.
Well, you still have to split it even if you're not splitting it.
But I confess to you on that, I'm not an expert.
Okay.
That's where the accountants, I don't do returns.
Okay.
And accountants, they've got to know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there implications to people who are doing business internationally any way, shape, or form? Because I know that there is a move afoot for us to do more exporting, obviously.
If you have, first of all, the money has to be generated by a United States business, a domestic business in the United States. But if you've got foreign investors, for example, our Mexican or Canadian neighbors, or Germans or French, foreign investors, and they pay U.S. taxes, they get the deduction too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's pretty darn generous. And they can be completely passive. You don't have to be active in the business. As long as you're a bona fide business owner, you get it.
Mm-hmm. And it has to be cash. It's not, you're not getting some special treatment for accelerated depreciation or property that you own or, you know, some. I know there's been discussion about giving, some additional tax credits for buying equipment ahead of time and accelerating.
Well, actually, it's a good question because beneath these $315,100 and $157,000 figures that I mentioned, you don't want to be paying too many wages. And you, it's okay to buy property if you need it, but that's not going to, but that actually is going to be an expense. What you want to do is keep your expenses as low as possible so that your net income will be as high as possible. This is why you don't want to be an S corporation if you're below those figures that I just mentioned, because the federal income tax law requires you to pay yourself a reasonable compensation. You right. must do that so that you'll pay your FICA taxes.
Right.
But if you're so that's one reason why you don't want to be an S corporation and why you don't want to buy property. But if you're above 315 or 157, you want to pay maximum wages that make any kind of business sense, and you want to buy property all that you can reasonably afford, because your deduction is going to be determined above those numbers, usually by your wages and your property.
Right.
That's what it's going to be. So below, avoid them like the plague. Above these numbers I mentioned, 315 and 157,
right.
go
and,
wild.
And because I don't understand this, I'll ask the question. And there is a fundamental tension, as you mentioned, because if you want to qualify either yourself or people you bring in to qualify for various health care and other benefits, you have to pay them a certain amount of money. You have to have a certain percentage that they're making, right? That they have to make. Like I know that for I was in doing venture capital, as on both sides of the table for a little while, and we used to tell people when they start off, pay yourself the minimum wage, so that you can get, and then get deducted. We can get you health care, and we can get you some insurance and things like this. Is that still in play for LLCs?
Because remember, LLC is a law term,
right.
and subchapter S is a pure tax term, Mars and Venus. And so, the basic rule that applies here is under subchapter S, it's the rule I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that you've got to pay yourself reasonable
right.
compensation.
Right.
No one knows what that means.
And that just came out again a few years ago. I remember someone in the state was talking about what is reasonable compensation for certain professions.
Yeah. And it's a big issue in New Hampshire, because we have the business profits tax, and you pay that tax on your net business income. And so what people try to do is absolutely maximize their compensation, because that minimizes their net income, which minimizes their now 7.9% business profits tax.
Right. So as an expert in both these areas, both the income tax and the law, how friendly a state is New Hampshire to businesses? Is someone who's going to set up a business, are they better off going to Nevada, Delaware, Massachusetts, Georgia? I mean, where do you think in Europe? I know it's just an opinion. Where do you think we rank?
You've again touched a nerve. The way
that's our job here.
The way you attract people of talented people to come to the towns of New Hampshire is by having great schools. And my guess would be that in Bedford, you've got them in spades. But I've happened to do some canvassing up in Franklin a couple of weeks ago. And it's you talk to anybody and they're saying, our schools are terrible. Yeah. We can't afford decent schools.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know, frankly, what the solution is in Franklin. I hope they discover a solution. But I'm not going to move my family to Franklin because unless I can afford to send them to private schools, they're not going to get a decent education. I hope I'm not being unfair to the schools of Franklin, but they just don't have anywhere near the amount of money they need because the property's not very valuable, and it's paid for by property taxes. This is a heck of a way to pay for our children's education. It
right.
should be paid for by, guess what's coming, progressive income tax.
Mm-hmm. And again, what you're doing is you're reflecting on information, the perception people have. We're not commenting on what the Franklin schools are or are not. This is just a perception of the people.
This is what I'm told. I don't live
right.
in Franklin.
Yeah, exactly.
I live in
yeah.
Concord.
Well, Franklin, since we're talking about Franklin, yeah. they are trying to revitalize.
We've done some shows on what
yeah,
they're trying
on
to
Franklin,
do up there.
And there's a large effort that's underway.
Yeah. And I became aware of that when I was canvassing because a lot of people told me, I love this town, but the property taxes are a sin. And the people who are on Lakeside in Franklin, they're saying, I'm paying $7,000 a year just because I can see the lake. This is outrageous. How I can't retire because once I retire, I can't pay my property taxes
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah.
Well, New Hampshire seems to have a problem because we're an old and aging state.
We are.
We are. And we want to attract young people.
Young, highly educated people,
so
ideally,
yeah.
or at least hardworking people. They're not coming to towns that have rotten schools.
No.
I'm
and,
not saying that about Franklin.
Right,
I'm saying
just,
it generically.
Right.
And it's interesting. I heard a term the other day someone used to talk about the boomerangs. These are the people who you raise your children, they go away to school, and then they come back because they want to come back to where they grew up and they want to set up a business and they want to go. So it's a boomerang. It's a great term.
Well,
and that's what there are people, for example, I know I was reading an article. It's an initiative on the part of a couple of towns in New Mexico where they have a terrible brain drain going on. And that's what they're trying to do. They're launching an initiative to attract the boomerangs. We don't want to lose our young. We want them to go to Stanford, go to Columbia, go to Harvard, get a great education, and then come back here, set up businesses, and grow in our state. And that's a great initiative. Now, I don't know how successful they're going to be or how they're going to do it, but good. At least it's naming the issue, and that's a first step towards solving the problem.
I couldn't agree more. I have two daughters, and one of them lives in Rowayton, Connecticut, which is a four-hour drive. She and her husband and their three kids. It's hard for us to see the grandchildren. And the last place in the world my daughter Grayson would want to live is New Hampshire because there's no work for her here. My daughter Dana is in Sacramento getting some education, Sacramento, California. But there's no way she's coming back to New Hampshire unless we're incredibly lucky.
Well, you know, there's a lot going on in Manchester around technology and, you know, Dean Kamen's company, BioFab, and the Army Initiative, Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Initiative, which is, I'm told, is going to be ground zero for human tissue development and farming, which is going to spur the, you know, certainly the mills. And they're building a new hotel, I've heard, down, it's been in the newspapers by the river behind.
But to John's point, what's driving that and what is a prerequisite is the infrastructure of advanced schools and training and places you can go. So we need more Dartmouths. We need more of the high end education. And I think that some of the universities are trying to upgrade themselves and try to get a good national standing. But we've got a little ways to go.
We do.
They're going to revisit also the way the public schools are funded. I was reading about that today, that they thought it was time to revisit the Claremont decision. You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Andrew Valinsky, as you probably know, is very active in that area. And so I am also, to tell you the
Interesting.
Truth.
Interesting. You know, I did a little research before, and I don't know if you sent me the link. But, John, if you sent me the link, but it is from the Tax Foundation, and it's the rankings for each state. And so I'll just report on New Hampshire's tax rankings, according to this organization. Overall tax rank, anybody want to take a guess?
No.
No.
Because I'll be wrong, and I don't like to be
Number
wrong.
Number six,
okay.
We're number
sixth
six.
Best,
which,
sixth they're saying.
Best. Yes. Corporate taxes, not so good on this one. 45th in corporate taxes. Individual taxes, 9th. Sales tax, we can guess that.
High, I would think, but
right.
I don't know.
Number one.
Yeah, even higher than Florida, huh?
Yeah. Well, I'll have to, yeah, well, we're number one. Property tax, 44.
Yeah.
And unemployment insurance taxes, 44. So it looks like our sales tax carries us a long way.
Yeah.
The lack of sales tax.
Yeah.
It is difficult when I travel out of state and I go to purchase even a small item and I get to the cash register. It's kind of disarming that the money they're asking me for is not the money on the price tag.
Yes, yeah, agreed.
It's right.
Agreed.
But I do want to say, though, that to me, those numbers are interesting. They're a decent starting point, but in the end, they're meaningless unless you know about the overall situation of the state. And if it turns out that there's a few towns in the state, Bedford is probably very high on the list, that have great public schools, and a great many that do not.
Sure.
Concord has good schools. I've heard some not so great things about Manchester schools. I just don't know. But okay, the taxes are relatively low, but what about the roads? What, above all, about the schools? And if you've got real low taxes and schools that should be better, that's a problem.
Mm.
Sure. Well, we're coming towards the end of the show, and so we always sort of end with asking our guests to look into a crystal ball and tell us, what does the future hold? What do you see out 1, 3, 5 years from now in terms of some of the implications of this? Are we going to see, you know, will you judge the success of this initiative? And quite frankly, and this is meant in a very positive way, your crusade here, if we see a large number of organizations that go through this reorganization and finally get it right, is that one of the metrics that we should be looking at?
I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be slow. How can you look at a 20% deduction and not say, I want it? The problem is structuring so that you maximize it. And I think it's going to take years before the sort of the business culture is tuned into the idea that because of this deduction, you've got to completely change. You can't be a business corporation anymore. You've got to be an LLC. You can't be an S-Corp. You've got to be a partnership, or vice versa if you're above those dollar amounts. It's crazy. There's never been anything like this before, and it's going to take, I think, a long time for business people hundreds of thousands of very smart people in New Hampshire to get a feel for 199A.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you very much for being our guest. It was very interesting. You're a very engaging speaker and you have a lot of passion. I appreciate it and I value what you're doing. And we'd like you, if our audience wanted to get a hold of you, could you tell us again, perhaps your email or the best way to reach you if they wanted to reach out to you?
No, it's a secret.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Then reach out to Andrea.
No.
My phone number is 603-856-7172.
Again, one more time.
856-7172.
Okay.
And my email, if they want to get that overview of 199A in quotes, plain English, is lawjmc@comcast.net.
Right. And you do practice this as well. I mean, if they wanted to, they could engage you as an attorney and an advisor in this area.
A right? Resounding yes.
Okay, great.
And, you know, I'm going to speak prematurely, but I think the SBA would like to have John give a webinar to which anybody can participate if they happen to be fortunate enough to get an email.
One thing about 199A is there are infinite opportunities to teach and write,
That's great.
Well, we've come to the end here, and we're running a little tight on time. But what we like to do is we always turn to Andrea, who, as a business sage, as a mentor, as a mensch, as one of our leaders of our community, she always seems to have a bit of wisdom that she can share with the audience. Andrea, do you have such wisdom you can share with our listeners on Business IQ Radio here on 101.5 today?
I do, and It's a very simple philosophy and message, but aside from saying thanks for listening, I want you to all remember, you can spend more than you make, but you can only do it for so long.